The conventional understanding is that they were really good at organizing. I think that is partly true, but there were other factors.
They voted to strike after a stirring speech in Yiddish from Clara Lemlich, a founder of the ILGWU Local 25. The strike came to be known as the Uprising of 20,000.
For your first 2 weeks in America, you get arrested, you get thrown in a stockade, you get hit over the head by a cop, then you don't work for years. Didn't you think you wanted to go home? And he said, Bob, many times I think if the ocean's not water, I walk home.
From 1980 to 1995, during a time of significantly declining membership in most other American labor unions, the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, nearly doubled its membership. Dr. Timothy Minchin, a professor of history at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, explores how in an interview that was originally broadcast on the Tales from the Reuther Library podcast. On this week's Labor History in 2, Rick Smith tells us the story of the 1909 uprising of the 20,000. The Columbine Mine Massacre, which took place on November 21, 1927, was an important moment in the Colorado Mine Wars. Bob Rossi, who hosts a monthly labor segment on the Willamette Wake Up Show on KMUZ in Salem, Oregon, discusses miners organizing more generally, as well as some of the memories of that time from workers he interviewed in the 1980s. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. I hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Tales from the Reuther Library, a podcast that is still being recorded elsewhere than at the Walter P. Reuther Library on the campus of Wayne State University in the most amazing city of all, Detroit, Michigan. I am Dan Galadner, along with Troy Eller English. So today's episode, we talked with labor historian Timothy Minchin, a professor at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, who wrote a nice piece earlier this year in the journal Labor History called A Successful Union in the Era of Decline, Interrogating the Growth of the Service Employees International Union, 1980-1995. Now, if anybody knows anything about U.S. labor union history, the 1980s was not the best decade for American unions, starting with the air traffic controller strike when President Reagan fired 11,359 controllers, and then with that stroke of the pen, a signal went up to the employers and management that it was time to bury the unions, that employers could legally use scabs during strikes, and there was really nothing that could be done about it. So they did, and they used other techniques of harassment that decimated the union movement in America. And to make matters even worse, Reagan appointed the chair of the National Labor Relations Board, Donald Dotson, who believed that collective bargaining was the destruction of individual freedom. So everything that President Truman said back in 1940, which he said, that unions are woven into our economic pattern of American life and collective bargaining is part of the democratic process, well, those days were now over. But there was a glimmer of hope. There was organizing that was going on from the public sectors, AFT and AFSCME, they were growing, as well as the SEIU. They both were, you know, SEIU is growing in public and private sector, and in a variety of workplaces, from healthcare to janitors. The SEIU did increase their membership in the 1980s to the 90s, partly due to mergers, of course, but they organized like crazy. So there was a glimmer of hope within the union movement, and we're going to find out more about that with this episode. Now, we're going to find out how they did it, what was different about their organizing structure, and their outreach to community. Now, there's another special addition to this episode. We also have a co-interviewer. I dragged in the virtual studio Sarah Lebowitz, our SEIU archivist, because she helped out Minchin in so many ways. He's in Australia. We're in Detroit. She did tons of scanning for him. So I thought it'd be a great idea that they can sit down and talk and get to know each other a little more. So enjoy the episode, folks. Blah, Tim, thank you so much for being part of Tales of the Reuther. We really do appreciate you talking to us from around the world.
Thank you, Dan. It's great to be here. I'm joining you today from Melbourne, Australia.
Yep. And this is the amazing thing now about Zoom. We are cutting back on our long distance calls to be able to do this kind of stuff. So I'm so glad to be able to talk to you, because the article you wrote on the SAIU is very fascinating. We always hear about how, especially us in the labor world, how during the 80s, it was the death knell to labor. They were constantly losing membership. But then here's like the public sector unions, AFT, AFSCME, and then of course the SAIU. And you're paper's talking about this growth. Can you give us a rundown of why you think this happened for the SAIU? Was it, as you say, they were in the right place at the right time, you think?
Yeah, well, I think it was several factors. I mean, I think the conventional understanding is that they were really good at organizing. I think that is partly true. They were good at organizing and they put a lot of resources into it. And they recognized the importance of organizing, probably more before a lot of other unions did. But there were other factors. I think it was really important that they operated in a growing part of the economy. So the service sector obviously is a really growing part of the economy, and it's been the growing part of the economy for most of the post-World War II period. So they had advantages in the sense that other unions didn't have, particularly in manufacturing, where membership was falling. So that was an important factor. They operated in a growing part of the economy. Also, as I explained in the article, they did pick up members through affiliations of independent unions. So a lot of states had government employee unions that were independent that affiliated with the SAIU in the 1980s in particular. But at the same time, the SAIU was good at, you know, getting those unions to affiliate with it and reaching out to them, which is part of organizing as well. But the affiliations was another reason why they grew as well. So operating within a growing part of the economy and affiliations were two important factors as well. They had good leadership as well, which, you know, John Sweeney was an innovative president and was elected relatively young, put a big commitment to organizing. And he formed this partnership with Andy Stern, who was the organizing director, and they really were an effective team in this period in concentrating on growth and organizing and being determined to, you know, grow the union. So I think those factors were really important overall. Yeah, finally, the public sector bargaining rights, they operated in a period when public sector workers were being given more bargaining rights. And this was particularly true in the 70s and 80s, and that helped as well. So those are, I think, were the main factors.
So you, okay, Tim, I really, really, really do appreciate the time you've taken to explain your article that you've had out. And thank you so much for participating in Tales of the Reuther.
Keep up the progress that we've made. We've come a long way and united we'll stay, 'cause we can't forget the price that has been paid. The struggles of the workers before us, and now we join our voices in the chorus. We need the union, UNION, to help keep up the progress we've made. Our union is the SEIU. We work in service, that's what we do. Our members always give it their best, for rich and poor and all of the rest. We need the union, UNION, to help keep up the progress that we've made. We've come a long way and united we'll stay, 'cause we can't forget the price that has been paid. The struggles of the workers before us, and And now we join our voices in the chorus. We need the union, U-N-I-O-N, to help keep up the progress that we've made.
Everybody sing.
We need the union, U-N-I-O-N, to help keep up the progress that we've made. We've come a long way and united we'll stay, 'cause we can't forget the price that has been paid. The struggles of the workers before us, and now we join our voices in the chorus. We need the union, U-N-I-O-N, to help keep up the progress that we made. To help keep up the progress that we made.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1909. That was the evening when a crowd began to gather at the Cooper Union in the heart of New York City's shirtwaist garment-making industry. A meeting had been called by the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, Local 25, to discuss whether garment workers should go out in a general strike. Working conditions and pay throughout the industry were abysmal. It was common for workers to toil 11 hours a day with only a 30-minute lunch break 7 days a week. But organizing all these workers was a challenge. Many spoke various dialects of Yiddish or Italian, so organizing had to take place in multiple languages. But slowly, the organizing efforts began to build and show results. Pickets and walkouts were held against some employers. The union called a meeting to discuss what to do next. They voted to strike after a stirring speech in Yiddish from Clara Lemlich, a founder of the ILGWU Local 25. The strike came to be known as the Uprising of 20,000. It lasted until February. In a settlement, more than 300 factories agreed to recognize the union. A song from the educational department of the ILGWU captured the spirit of the strike. The lyrics began, "In the black winter night of 1909, we froze and bled on the picket line. We showed the world that women could fight, and we rose and won with women's might." The song continued, "And we gave new courage to the men who carried on in 1910. And shoulder to shoulder we'll win through, led by the ILGWU."
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
The Columbine Mine Massacre, which took place on November 21st, 1927, was an important moment in the Colorado Mine Wars. Bob Rossi, who hosts a monthly labor segment on the Willamette Wake Up Show on KMUZ in Salem, Oregon, talked with Labor History Today's Patrick Dixon about miners organizing more generally, as well as some of the memories of that time from workers he interviewed in the 1980s. Here's Patrick.
Thanks for joining us today on the show, Bob. I'm interested to talk to you about the 1927 Great Colorado Coal Strike, and I know this is a particular strike, a particular historical moment that you've been interested in for decades. Can you tell us a bit, for those who haven't heard about the strike, what were the events preceding it? How did it come about?
Thanks for the question. So the 1927-28 strike capped a decade of struggle of coal miners and coal mine workers in Colorado. The industry had been in crisis since 1921 or 22. The United Mine Workers had had a base there, but lost that base by 1925. And for many years, large numbers of Colorado coal miners had no union. In August of 1927, the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, called a strike in southern Colorado to protest the executions of Sacco and Vanzetti, two Italian anarchists who were on death row in Massachusetts. And the southern Colorado coalfields were the most difficult to organize because they were dominated by the Rockefeller-owned Colorado Fuel and Iron Company, and they had never been union. the strike was overwhelmingly successful in the sense that almost all of the mines shut down. I think of the thousands of workers in the southern field, only perhaps 40 went to work on the 2 days of the strike. It's remarkable to think that the IWW, which was then almost gone, could be in Colorado and call a strike to save the lives of two Italian anarchists 3,000 miles away and get that kind of response. Of course, they didn't save Sacco and Vanzetti's lives. They were executed. But the workers went back to work after a few days out. The workers then formulated demands in Aguilar, Colorado, which is a small town between Walsenburg and Trinidad, and then did what they needed to do legally to certify a strike, and then went out again in late September and stayed out until early or mid-February of 1928. They eventually won the demands for a $7.50 raise, which was an issue for coal miners and coal mine workers all over the country. And for a time, they were the highest paid mine workers in the United States. They eventually lost that wage, but other things happened that gave the strike a very long-lasting impact. We felt the impact of that strike into the 1970s.
What was that impact all the way through the 1970s then?
There were several things. First of all, Josephine Roche, who had come into control of the Rocky Mountain Fuel Company in northern Colorado, was a very progressive woman in Colorado at the time, built her political career by signing a contract with the United Mine Workers rather than the IWW. And that became the only union mine, or the only union mines, I should say, in Colorado for many years. Roche went on to run for governor of Colorado. She wasn't successful. She did join the Roosevelt administration and wrote the coal codes that helped save the coal industry from completely falling apart during the Depression. Later, she went to work for the United Mine Workers and became a director of the union's health and welfare funds, which were historic pension and welfare funds that did much to, I'll say save, I think that's not too dramatic a term, save coal regions around the country after the Second World War and into the 1960s when production was slowing or longwall mining was taking over. And those funds provided our health and welfare funds and kept small towns alive. Later, mine workers who protested the cuts in the funds encountered Roche again in the late 60s and early 70s. I should say late 60s. I think she was pretty baffled why anyone was objecting to the way the funds were being managed. But that miners' movement transformed the United Mine Workers, and I think that helped transform the labor movement in the 70s. That was one effect. Also, there were the IWW's attorney was a guy named Ray Henderson. He was blind. He went on to found the National Federation for the Blind. He defended John Steinbeck's book, Grapes of Wrath, when there were attempts to censor it. Hmm. And he had much to do with the modern farm worker movement. Sam Embry, who was the main organizer for the IWW in Colorado, went on to organized for the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers. And his daughter married Maurice Travis, who headed the union for a time. Maurice Travis was mentored by Embry, and he was convicted of not signing or lying when he signed a Taft-Hartley affidavit. He was ultimately found innocent in the courts. He received the longest jail sentence and the stiffest fine of anyone charged with refusing to sign or improperly signing a Taft-Hartley affidavit. He beat that in court, but he was broken personally as a result of that, I think. And those are just some of the tie-ins that went later on.
Now, you mentioned to me previously in our correspondence that you had some family history in the Colorado mines and that you, in the 1980s, spoke to and interviewed many children of strikers from 27, 28, and even some of the survivors. What were some of the memories or some of the things that stood out most to you about that?
I had distant relatives who lived in Silpris, which is a coal town west of Trinidad. Silpris doesn't exist anymore. It's been replaced by a lake. My family came from northern Italy, and many of the mine workers in Colorado were from their region in Italy, and strong ties existed between the anthracite region, where most of my family settled, in Colorado. In fact, anthracite mine cultures influenced to a great degree the development of union consciousness and class consciousness in Colorado. There were lots of stories that people told me. I went door to door in many of the small towns talking to people, or I would set up in a bar and the person behind the bar would start calling people and people would drop by to talk to me, and then I made connections with folks and would drop by their homes as well and were welcomed in. One story that really stands out for me came from an earlier era, a guy named Dan Bonacci, who came from near where my family was from in Italy, told me this story of emigrating from Italy to Colorado, and he made it across the ocean and then across the United States, but while he was traveling, mine workers went out on strike during the famous Ludlow strike. And Dan jumped off of the train as it was pulling into Walsenburg, not knowing that the area was under martial law. He had to relieve himself, and he didn't know that the area was under martial law, of course, and he wanted to just be ready to see his family who were waiting at the end of the platform. While he was in the bushes, he felt this jab on his back, and he turned around, and it was a National Guardsman. Dan didn't speak English well enough to explain who he was or what he was doing, and the assumption was if he jumped off the train early and he was Italian, he was a union organizer. And he was taken to a stockade and held there for some days. And other mine workers who got out found his family and said, oh, your relative is in the stockade. And his family went down to get him out. And a National Guardsman was there in their meeting. And he had to sign something saying he would scab, he would cross picket lines. And they told him in Italian, look, just sign the thing, you're not going to cross the picket line. He went out, he got out, and he went downtown. He had gifts and letters for people, and he was handing them out because so many people in Walsenburg had come from the same area that he had. And the sheriff, Shorty Martinez, walked up to him and to the crowd and said, this is an illegal assembly. I'm going to walk to the end of the block. If I come back and you're still here, you're all going to jail. And the Italians ignored that. Shorty Martinez walked to the end of the block, came back, pulled out his pistol and cracked my friend over the head, and he carried him up to a union pool hall, and a doctor came at night and stitched him up. And the strike went on for another 2 or 3 years, and no one worked. There were scabs, but very few, and they came from out of the region. And people, Dan said, people had nervous breakdowns. Some people went back to Italy. Some people left the mining completely. Some people moved on to other coal fields. Some people took work on ranches, but I didn't know anyone who scabbed. And I said, well, your first 2 weeks in America, you get arrested, you get thrown in a stockade, you get hit over the head by a cop, then you don't work for years. Didn't you think you wanted to go home? Didn't you think about just turning around and going back? And he said, Bob, many times I think if the ocean's not water, I walk home. And the story is important to me because it begins to describe the culture of workers' control and union consciousness and resistance that I think makes the Colorado coal miners exceptional and interesting. There were other stories. Women told me of being working in boarding houses, and I had not been aware of how hard that work was. One coal miner said they worked harder than we did in the mines. The boarding houses really functioned as centers of working class care in many ways, and as a base for working class life and culture and interaction. The boarding house women did serve something like an apprenticeship. It was a very hard job. It required a knowledge of math. It required amazing physical strength, ability to plan menus and apportion food. One boarding house woman told me she had a test. People would come to the boarding house to board, and she would look at their hands. And if they weren't calloused hands, she figured they were up to no good and wouldn't let them in.
In most historic mining communities, the mining jobs are no longer there in many cases, or there are a lot fewer. Do you feel like there's still a historical memory that exists among the descendants of these communities, that they have a certain idea of consciousness or what it means to be working class?
Yes, I do. I think that's true. Now, there's still an annual commemoration at the Ludlow Monument in Colorado, and I attended many times, and it's still a very moving event. Of course, there are no survivors of Ludlow living now, but those events have a lot of meaning. Now, I think one thing that we have to think about here is that miners in the 1920s, and well, the teens and 20s and into the 30s, were transient many times. So you had people coming in from Michigan and Illinois and Pennsylvania mines and coke-producing regions into Colorado and bringing union traditions with them. You had union traditions in Colorado. And then people dispersed and went all through the West into the West Coast. So tradition is hard to nail down, but there were specific traditions that hung on, and I think that when we think about the 20s, we have to think about it as a time of defeat. That's true for unions, but it was also a time of great debate and discussion, and those discussions led to other union drives and the modern farm worker movement, I would say. I think the 27-28 strike was foundational to Chicano consciousness in Colorado. I think the modern farm worker movement owes much to the 27-28 strike, and there is a consciousness of that.
Thanks again for sharing. Is there anything else you feel like I might have left out?
I think we need to remember that the 27-28 strike happened at some great human cost. Six mine workers were killed at the Columbine mine when machine guns were trained on them. That was a mine that Josephine Roach owned. The Colorado Fuel and Iron Company mines did not go union until the 1930s. The Colorado Fuel and Iron Steel Mill was very central to their, in Pueblo, was very central to their operations. Today there's a wonderful museum at the Colorado Fuel and Iron Steel Mill in Pueblo, Colorado, that I hope people will visit and think about. One of the things that moved the strike forward and made the movement in the 1920s in Colorado successful was that there was a common cultural framework established between Chicanos and Italians. Now, I think by the end of the 1930s, that was fraying or was largely gone, but for the teens and 20s, that was a really important form of working class solidarity that we can't overlook. The other thing was is that the IWW won its main wage demand that no other union, and that the United Mine Workers at that time could not win the $7.50 wage back, despite really strong and heroic efforts, but that the IWW couldn't hold on to the win because they didn't believe in signing timed contracts. Those are some lessons and things that remain with us to the present day.
Thank you. I really appreciate you sharing some of your recollections and for sharing your time with me today.
Well, thank you very much.
And the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run. There can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. What force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app, and even better, you can like it there and pass it along. Our music today included We Need the Union by Priscilla White of SEIU Local 1199P from the Union Plus Song Contest. And for members of SEIU District 1199, we'd heard rousing renditions of This Little Light of Mine, and Solidarity Forever, sung at their 2010 Leadership Assembly in Fort Mitchell, Kentucky. Labor History Today is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org, where there are links to nearly 80 labor radio and podcast shows. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdeck. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time.